This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on October 4th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Open session for Thursday, October 4th, 2012 will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for September 20th, 2012. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the minutes for the meeting of September 20th, 2012 as set forth in agenda document number 12-68.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, we have a few late submitted documents.
We do. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-69, 12-69A, 12-70, which is for discussion purposes only. We're not going to vote on it. Let's see. Is there anything else late? Did I miss any? I think that's it.
Okay. Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it 6-0. Thank you. The first item on the first AO on the agenda.
Do we have to do the Sunshine Act?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Do you have another motion?
I do. I have a Sunshine Act motion. I move that the commission add to the agenda consideration of draft advisory opinion 2012-32 and the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia order in Van Hollen v. FEC, and that the commission determine pursuant to 11 CFR 2.7D that a business so requires and no earlier public announcement was possible.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is the discussion of draft advisory opinion 2012-25, American Future Fund. We have with us this morning Mr. Michael Bays and Mr. Jason Torchinsky. Please join us in the event that we have any questions for you. We have a presentation from the Office of General Counsel, Mr. Nevin Stepanovic.
Thank you, Chair Hunter.
Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1269 and 1269A respond to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of American Future Fund, American Future Fund Political Action, Mr. David McIntosh, and David McIntosh for Indiana. The requesters propose to engage in a joint fundraising effort by creating two joint fundraising committees. One proposed joint fundraising committee would involve American Future Fund and American Future Fund Political Action as participants. The other proposed joint fundraising committee would add an independent expenditure-only committee as participant. The requesters ask whether their proposed joint fundraising effort would be consistent with the Act. The requesters had initially proposed to establish two other joint fundraising committees, both of which would have involved the participation of a federal candidates or office holders authorized campaign committee. The requesters, however, have withdrawn their questions relating to these two proposed joint fundraising committees. There are three drafts before you. All three concluded that two proposed joint fundraising committees involving American Future Fund, American Future Fund Political Action, and or an independent expenditure-only committee may operate consistent with the Act. The drafts, however, differ in their analysis. These drafts were drafted before the requesters have withdrawn their questions relating to federal candidates' involvement. Consequently, all three drafts also address the requesters' questions that have since been withdrawn. The Commission received one comment on the advisory opinion request and none on the advisory opinion drafts. I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments for the requester?
If the Commission is unable to agree on the reasoning for the answers to the two questions that still remain, but everybody agrees that the answer is still yes, if we could get, you know, we would prefer kind of a bare-bones answer, even if each commissioner has different reasoning for how they get there. I just want to sort of put that out
sure.
on the table.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. We actually don't anticipate – he said, shouldn't you raise your hand?
Thanks, guys.
Sorry. We don't anticipate voting on this today, and we anticipate working. We're actually right now working on a compromise draft that we hope to get to the same answers in the ones that we've put out. But we just weren't able to come up with something that we could make blue before this meeting today. We hope to do that after this meeting, but we thought it'd be fruitful to at least discuss the proposals that are on the table. And my understanding is that the 60-day deadline for this request is October 9th, and. We wanted to consider asking you if we could, because you had offered to extend the deadline even further if we needed it. I wanted to wait and see if we thought it might be fruitful to discuss this again at the next public meeting. If so, that meeting is October 18th. If not, I think we can render an opinion sometime next week. So.
Yeah, if you guys could do it sometime next week, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Good to know. Any questions or comments on the draft? Does the requester have any comments on the drafts regarding the different analyses provided?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
No preferences, comments?
Nope.
Okay. All right.
As long as we get to yes, the reasoning is less important to me.
Okay, good to know. All righty. Well, we will work to come up with something. We'll make it blue in sufficient time for you to comment on it, and then we will endeavor to vote on it before the 60-day deadline of October 9th.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is the discussion of Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-32, Tea Party Leadership Fund. We have a presentation from Ms. Wallstriker, and Mr. Backer, you're more than welcome to join us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 1270 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by the Tea Party Leadership Fund, Sean Bialot, and John Race. Please note that this is an expedited advisory opinion request under Section 437F(a)(2) of the Act. Under that section, an advisory opinion requested by a candidate within 60 days before the candidate's election must be issued by the Commission within 20 days after the complete request is received. And the 20-day deadline for the Commission to issue this advisory opinion request is a week from today, October 11th. The Tea Party Leadership Fund is a non-connected political committee. They registered with the Commission in May 2012. It represents that it has made contributions to seven candidates, including $2,500 each to Mr. Bialot and Mr. Race, and that it has received contributions from over 4,500 persons. Mr. Bialot is a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives for Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District, and Mr. Race is a candidate for the U.S. Senate for West Virginia. The committee wishes to contribute an additional $2,500 each to Mr. Bialot and Mr. Race, which would exceed the contribution limits for persons other than multi-candidate political committees. The requesters ask whether the committee may make, and Mr. Bialot and Mr. Race may accept, contributions up to the higher limit for multi-candidate committees before the six-month period for qualifying as such a committee has elapsed. The draft concludes that at this time, the Act prohibits the Tea Party Leadership Fund from making, and Mr. Bialot and Mr. Race from accepting, contributions in excess of $2,500 per election. We received one comment on the request and two comments on the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. And as noted, the 20-day deadline in this advisory opinion is Thursday, October 11th. Our next public meeting is October 18th, so we thought it prudent to have a public discussion on this request, although we will be accepting any written comments through the 10-day statutory comment period, which expires tomorrow, October 5th. And again, we will not vote on this today, but we wanted to have a public discussion before we vote on it. Any questions or comments for the Office of General Counsel or the requester, Mr. Backer? Commissioner McGann.
Since Mr. Backer's joined us, so ask him a few questions. And first, I want to. We're not voting today because there's a 10-day rule, and there's a comment that brought that to our attention, albeit in a rather scratchy fashion. But we were aware of that before
the comment came in.
Right?
Yes, we were aware of that.
Right, but
yes.
We appreciate when people bring that stuff to our attention. The issue is. It seems like you're challenging the multi-candidate PAC regime where you have to wait at least 6 months before you become a multi-candidate PAC, which is what the statute says. Right? It's not a creature of FEC regulation. This is a statutory question. You filed comments that say correctly that that administrative agencies can, when interpreting statutes and even their own regs, consider constitutional issues. There's a mountain of case law that says when we construe things, we can avoid constitutional doubt, that sort of thing. All of that's true. I'm not sure everyone at the commission, since it's opened its doors, agrees that it's as true as some of us think it is, but it's a matter of degree, not kind. But this is not a difference of degree. In this case, it seems more difference of kind. Even if we could construe the statute to avoid constitutional doubt, that's not what you're asking. It seems like you're asking us to say the statute's unconstitutional. So my question is, how does an agency get to do that? If you're coming at us with two reads of the statute, one reading causes a constitutional problem because of a case, and the other doesn't, I could see saying I agree that we should take the course more certain and less fraught with constitutional problem. But that doesn't seem to be the question here. It seems to be there's one way to read the statute. I think we all agree there's one way to read the statute, and that way is unconstitutional, and the agency should say that. Am I misstating the question? And if I'm not misstating the question, how do I have the power to do that?
I would suggest that the question is a little narrower. It's not that the six-month prior restraint is unconstitutional on its face. It's unconstitutional as applied to this particular client committee, because as the commission notes in its blue draft, the statute exists purely to prevent circumvention of the contribution limits, which is a very legitimate government interest. But here, that the restriction is perhaps not narrowly drawn enough to permit activity that by an organization that on its face is clearly not a vehicle of anti-circumvention. It's when we filed this request, we had 4,500 contributors. I think we're north of 6,000 and change right now. This is an organization that is driven by small dollar donors, and to apply a statute that is expressly intended to prevent the circumvention of contribution limits by very wealthy individuals to an organization that clearly is in no way doing so would seem to be unconstitutional as applied to this particular group. To the extent that the commission can take that into consideration, we would hope there would be a way to prevent this committee from being subject to penalty of law. Now, this committee should probably not be subject to that particular restraint, or at a minimum, there should be a mechanism to allow a committee that is clearly not engaging in anti-circumvention activity to not be so restrained.
Merely because your client doesn't want to circumvent the limits and they're not going to use the PAC contribution limits to end run their own individual limits, I don't see how that gets us where we're going, because you could have someone, for example, who says the biannual limit ought not apply to me because I'm not trying to corrupt or create the appearance of corruption, right? I'm not looking to compromise or create the appearance of compromise of this member of Congress, so I should be able to give more than $2,500. Just because you're not trying to, right? Now, if you're saying that it just doesn't, this anti-circumvention thing just doesn't work anymore, I could see that perhaps in the future because the individual limits are tied to inflation and they raise and the PAC limits aren't. And at a certain point when an individual can give more than a PAC, it's hard to say that the PAC could then circumvent the limits, I suppose, without the waiting period, although I do see an argument that says you still could wait because it makes it a little bit more tougher to use a PAC to double your own limit or whatnot. But sitting here today, you still have limits that are different, and the individual limit is different than the PAC limit, and I still see that the anti-circumvention rationale still works sitting here today. And I don't understand how it doesn't work for your client or why your client's different than everyone else.
I would suggest our client is no different than anybody else and ought to have the same ability to engage in multi-candidate political committee speech as the Teamsters Political Action Committee or GE's Political Action Committee or a group of – or any non-connected PAC that was organized a few days earlier than we were. I think the it's kind of an unfortunate way that the timing worked out, but for this organization, these close to 6,000-plus individuals to – be denied the same speech rights as everybody else who's been around a few days longer seems to me the wrong outcome here. And I recognize that there is certainly a difficulty in finding a way to get to that result. But the contra is we see that there's a rule here. The rule as applied generally makes a lot of sense. In this particular circumstance, it doesn't. And that, you know, there ought to be a way to not enforce a statute or not subject a committee to the penalties of violating a statute where the entire purpose and the express purpose of that statute is not at issue here. It's not that our client, this committee, does not intend to violate the multi-candidate is not intending to corrupt members of Congress. It's that as just a function of its existence and how it's evolved, it will not act to be a vehicle for circumvention. The argument would then be if this somehow were made possible, hundreds of donors would suddenly come to us with $5,000 contributions, and then that we would then, you know, accept these earmarked contributions and give them out to their favorite candidates. It's a bit of a stretch. It's a small organization.
Earmarked, it would still be the individual limit.
Well, the
PAC limit if it's earmarked through the PAC.
The improperly earmarked transactions. But my point is that the contra is here's a statute that has applied to this particular organization of thousands of individuals. It simply denies them the same rights of free speech they would have if they associated in some other way. But they're choosing to associate this way. And where the rationale of the statute simply doesn't apply here, it would seem that enforcing the statute fully on this committee would lead to a bad outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think there ought to be a mechanism of – and maybe perhaps there isn't, but it seems to me there should be some way – to prevent the rights of this group of individuals from being thrown under the bus for the benefit of what is certainly a legitimate government interest.
Let's assume all that's right. How does that get you an advisory opinion? I mean, is the advisory opinion process really under the Act designed to flesh out areas where you think the agency may have discretion? I mean, I think that's – my view is it's not. And I don't really know of an example of an AO where the agency has said the rule of law is X, but we're going to, in our discretion, not enforce on a particular requester because of, you know, burden or small change or de minimis or not a priority of the commission or all the other things the commission lists when they, you know, dismiss cases, you know, on the enforcement side. I just don't know how we do this in an AO because it still seems like really – that's at least close – at least that's not – you're asking us to declare the statute unconstitutional. But how do we do this in an AO? Is the AO really a proper vehicle for this?
And it may be that an AO is not a proper vehicle, but I think if you look at this in the historical context of when the law was passed and the amendments were passed and how it evolved, you can look at the weight of precedent and say, you know, this probably, you know, based on the rulings of the court, it would seem that in this case it is not constitutional as applied to this particular entity and therefore there needs to be a remedy. Much in the same way that if you look at the Club for Growth AOR 2009, I believe 2010-09 or 2010-11, I forget which one. You had a string of very recent court cases that were very clearly on point that this commission looked at and said, well, look, based on this precedent, we have to issue this. I think here you've got a much, much longer 30-year history of cases that have where this issue has probably never come up before, but given the explosive growth of grassroots and outside actors in politics and political speech and the many new organizations that are out there, it's only now becoming an issue. And I think the issue is certainly not going to go away. It's going to be a bigger issue as time goes on, as more and more individuals enter the political speech arena. The system that probably made a lot of sense when it was first passed, but doesn't really comport to the string of cases and changes to the law. Well, I think there's an opportunity to make some room here.
Well, there absolutely is. And that's, we get in the cab and we go down to the place in the White Dome and we tell all this to them, because that's really the place to go with a lot of the argument. On the one hand, you cite AOs that the commission, I think, correctly recognized that there was existing case law that called into doubt the premise of the issue in those AOs, and I think the commission is duty-bound to apply those cases, and the commission did in several of them, not all of them, but several of them. But then you say, but this is what your situation hasn't come up yet, and there really isn't a case, so because there isn't a case, therefore we should assume there might be a case someday, and then and just let's nip this all in the bud and just do it right here at the commission. You know, personally, maybe the 6 months is too long. Maybe it should be 3 months. Maybe it should be 5 months. Maybe it shouldn't be giving contributions to five candidates. Maybe it should be 10. Maybe it should be two. Maybe it should be three. Maybe having 50 contributors, maybe that's too many. Maybe that's not enough. We can debate that all day long if we were a legislature, but we're not. So I'm not sure what we can do here. I mean, if you want to do an as-applied challenge to the constitutionality of the act, I don't see that the commission's empowered to do that, and that moves it to the other branch, not the White Dome, but a couple blocks away, around 4th, 5th Street, go there. And I'm not being flip. I'm being conversational on this. I don't know what I can do. Even if I were to agree with you that it's odd that there's still this multi-pack deal, and once upon a time it made a lot of sense, and it's making less and less sense today, which maybe is true, I'm not sure what I can do, because what you don't have is a case, and maybe there is a case and we haven't gotten to it yet, meaning maybe it exists and we just haven't gotten to it in our discussion, that calls into question the regime that's on the books. I mean, this is not... So it doesn't jump out to me that whether you look at Wisconsin Right to Life or Davis or Citizens United or Speech Now or Unity 08 or Emily's List or even cases that concern state laws, recent Eighth Circuit decision, you know, I don't see the – it doesn't jump out at me that those give us the hook to construe the act in a way that doesn't reach what you're doing. I'm not hearing it here. If I'm missing it, I'm going to give you one more chance to explain it to me. But I'm not seeing what we can do, other than to say we can't say yes that the act doesn't apply to you in an AO context.
I keep thinking about this in the sort of in a slightly different perspective. Hypothetically, if Congress were to pass an amendment to FECA that said all political committees must wait 6 months from the time they're registered before they're allowed to make any contributions whatsoever, I think everyone would agree that that's probably unconstitutional on its face. But if this were passed as statute and a matter came here, would the commission then feel bound to say, well, look, this is clearly unconstitutional. We can't sit here and say that we don't have the authority to not enforce this, that we have the duty to enforce a statute we think is clearly unconstitutional. And I think this is a very narrow area.
But that's not the case here. I don't see the parallel. I mean, that assumes you're going to have the entire Congress do something that's obviously unconstitutional and knowingly do it if it's that obvious and then to kick it over here. I mean, I guess they could pass a law that says the FEC is to ensure that the currency is on the gold standard. Right? I mean, they can do a lot. It's give me something a little bit more tied to the facts of this case.
I think with the specifically to this matter, you have a legitimate government interest. You have a narrowly drawn mechanism to protect that government interest. I think the mechanism is still sweeping in that conduct, which it ought to be permissible, into that prohibition. And it seems that there ought to be a way for an agency to recognize and address that without the necessity of, for example, going to another branch of government for redress. And perhaps there isn't a mechanism, but it would seem that putting that burden on speakers seems somewhat unreasonable.
Okay, I'll bite. This isn't obviously unconstitutional to me. Let's assume that the agency can and AO say, yeah, you know, you're right. There's a problem here. I don't see the problem. You know, I'm not at all confident you go to court. I don't see this as a slam dunk winner for you in court. What am I missing there? Is it?
Our read on the authorities and the case involved and the legislative and litigation history here, we think it probably would be a likely win in court, simply because this is clearly a prior restraint.
Likely would be. I mean, that's, you really want me to go out on that limb with you?
Fair enough. We feel very strongly that, you know, as an attorney, I hate making absolute statements, we believe that this particular statute, as applied to our client, is unconstitutional because it is a prior restraint on speech that discriminates against speakers based on identity and timing. We think it doesn't survive constitutional muster as applied to this particular organization, and it seems unreasonable that speakers now have to go to court in order to address that concern, these issues, rather than have an intermediate mechanism that would allow them to avoid the application of a statute that is applied to them as unconstitutional. I may be overreaching in that, though.
Wait a second. If someone wants to give to your PAC today, mm-hmm. they can give to the PAC today.
Yes.
Right. If they want to give to a candidate today, they can give to a candidate today.
Yes.
Right. The PAC, if it wants to give to a candidate today, can give to a candidate today.
Yes.
The difference is how much the PAC can give to a candidate.
Yes.
So when we talk about free speech of all these people, the PAC's a separate entity, right? The Supreme Court told us that in Citizens United, right? It has its own speech rights, if you will, mm-hmm. different from those of the individual. Is it the individual that's being compromised? Because if it is, then you are saying they can circumvent and get a little extra bonus on their individual limits by running money through a PAC. I don't think you're suggesting that.
No.
I don't see where you're going. I mean, I understand the idea of you have PACs being treated differently and there's language that says you can't treat speakers differently and all that. But for contribution limit purposes, courts have also upheld different contribution limits depending on all sorts of things. Every state has different limits for their state officials, for example. I mean, there's different reasons why there's different limits. I mean, some people are still banned from giving directly. So even in the federal system, different limits have been upheld. I'm just not seeing the slam dunk here that I just – I'm not seeing – I'm not – again, when if the contrary – if there was some – I don't see the harm.
I think the harm is not just to the speech rights of the legal entity, but also to the associational rights of the thousands of people who are contributing to this entity because they agree with it, they share its values, they want to see the values of this entity promulgated. They're contributing in an associational context.
Right, but they can do that, right? They can give.
But the value and their support and the ability for that associational speech to have an impact is somehow less valuable than the rights of members of the Teamsters Union or the senior executives of General Electric. It seems to me that discriminating the multi-candidate, the six-month waiting period is on its face and expressly created as an anti-circumvention rationale or mechanism. And where you don't have circumvention going on and where you have these individuals who want to speak in the same or associate in the same way as GE executives or teams members of the Teamster or union members of the Teamsters, that according to their association with less speech rights is somehow discriminatory to their interests. I certainly appreciate that there are differences in how much individuals may contribute and different contribution limits throughout the federal regime. But where you have this isn't a differentiation between two types of speakers. It's a differentiation between speakers based on how long they've wanted to speak. And at what point they decided that they wanted to engage in association political speech. I think that's the differentiation that's being made. And it's based on a legitimate government interest, but one that, as applied to this particular situation and probably many more situations to come, we think is unconstitutional. Okay. But again, perhaps the commission.
Just too much, and then I'll let it go. If I wanted to give to your PAC, how much could I give?
Right now, $5,000.
If I were a member of the Teamsters Union and the Teamsters PAC solicited me, how much could I give to the Teamsters PAC?
$5,000.
Okay, so there's no difference there.
Not on the mechanism, or rather the limit on the amount that they can contribute into their association.
Right.
So the value of that.
So my rights at this point, there's no discrimination there. Not being treated differently. The only difference is from the PAC's perspective whether they can give $5,000 or $2,500. Right.
And I would argue that the ability of the political action committee, the differences in the ability of the PAC to contribute, necessarily implicates the ability of the speech and association rights of those contributing to the political action committee.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the commenter correctly pointed out, we're not going to vote on this today. My mind is still open. If anybody wants to file any additional comments before the end of the comment period, I'm happy to consider them. But I agree with the chair. Since this is the only open meeting that we were going to have before your answer is due, it's probably of some value for people to hear at least where we're leaning. And where I'm leaning is, Mr. Becker, it's a pleasure to see you. My regards to your colleague, Mr. Hursting. You're always welcome here, but I think you're in the wrong place. Everything that you've said so far basically sounds to me like an as-applied constitutional challenge to the statute. Mere commissioners cannot afford you the relief that you seek. You need Article III judges for that. We can't strike down, either on a facial or an as-applied basis, we cannot strike down a provision of the law. It's true, you could go to Congress and lobby there for them to amend the law. I think a lot of people would like to see this law amended in a lot of different ways. Maybe you can get a coalition together, get some compromise going. That would be kind of cool. But we're not legislators, and we're not judges, and we can't strike down provisions of the law. We don't have a provision for issuing declaratory judgments that we would not enforce the law against you based on your constitutional concerns. I appreciate the authorities that you've cited and previous commissioners' statements that we should be sensitive to the Constitution, mindful of the Constitution. I like to think I'm a sensitive person, but I still can't strike down the law for you. So I also am sensitive to the fact that I know you in particular worry about administrative burdens and bureaucratic burdens. I would not wish you to think that you have an obligation to come here. I would not wish to – I think you're putting an administrative burden on yourself that you don't need. You don't need to be here if you – it sounds to me like you really want to sue over this law, and you're welcome to do so, but you don't need to come here first. You don't need our permission to sue us. You don't need an advisory opinion denying your request before you can go into court and say you think this is unconstitutional as applied to your client. If that's what you want to do, go forth. I don't wish to impose any additional delay or burden on that process. But I, you know, unless I get a comment in the next day or so that before the comment period runs that persuades me otherwise, it seems to me that we just can't give you what you're asking for.
Any other questions or comments, Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't belabor the point, but the requester is correct that the commission can clearly consider constitutional principles and case law when making enforcement and decisions when interpreting and construing the statute. In this case, there's really not a provision that's ambiguous or vague that we have to construe. I mean, 6 months is 6 months, so we're not in a situation where we need to look at competing interpretations and figure out which one may create constitutional problems and which ones may not. And this really does look more like directly as an as-applied challenge, and I think that there are limits on what the commission can do in this, especially in the advisory opinion context. You're absolutely right that in some other advisory opinions, Club for Growth, Common Sense 10, one, the National Defense AO that you brought some time ago where we had to consider the impact of the Emily's List case on your request and on existing statutory and regulatory provisions. But in this case, where we don't have an ambiguous statute, and as far as I can tell, we don't have the sort of intervening case law that we saw in those others, where we had Citizens United, Speech Now, Emily's List, that that did create some rather large questions about the underlying viability of some of the provisions that were on the books. I think that as commissioners, our hands are somewhat tied in what we can do at this particular stage. In terms of the administrative burden, depending on the court, some you may actually have to tag the space before moving forward. Some might consider this an exhaustion of administrative remedies before you can take it to court. And so, for that reason, I don't necessarily blame you for bringing this before the commission's attention. But we aren't making a decision today. But I do have that concern about what the commission can actually do in the AO context and what looks like an as-applied challenge.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Backer, for joining us this morning. We will give you an answer by the 20-day deadline, which, again, is Thursday, October 11th. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioners.
The next item on the agenda was Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-33, Pennsylvania Democratic Party. That advisory opinion request has been withdrawn by the requester. So the next matter on the agenda is Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party, A09-08. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. I'm Gary Hashey with the Audit Division. And good morning, Commissioners. This morning, the item before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum for the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. Our audit had two findings. The first finding is divided into two parts. There was a misstatement of financial activity. The Minnesota DFL misstated receipts and disbursements for calendar years 2007 and 2008. The misstatements were mainly due to unreported transfers from the non-federal accounts to the payroll account and unreported non-federal salaries and taxes paid from the payroll account. In response to the interim audit report recommendation, the Minnesota DFL amended its reports to correctly correct the misstatements, except for the reporting of the payroll account transactions for non-federal employees. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL misstated 2007-2008 activity and failed to report non-federal salaries and taxes paid from their payroll account. The second part of the misstatement finding included in the misstatement above, the Minnesota DFL received an in-kind contribution from an unknown source that was not reported nor disgorged to the U.S. Treasury when the permissibility of the funds could not be confirmed. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL misstated activity in 2008 and failed to report an in-kind contribution in the amount of $10,000. Since the source and permissibility of the contribution remains in question, the audit staff further recommends that the commission request that the Minnesota DFL disgorge $10,000 to the U.S. Treasury. Our second finding was an overfunding of federal accounts by the non-federal accounts. During the audit fieldwork, the analysis of the Minnesota DFL's transfers from its non-federal accounts indicated that the Minnesota DFL may have overfunded its federal accounts. In response to the interim audit report recommendation, the Minnesota DFL submitted additional documentation in conjunction with its amended reports, which showed that the committee did not overfund its federal account. The audit staff recommends that the commission find that the Minnesota DFL has demonstrated that its non-federal accounts did not overfund its federal accounts. We're happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Commissioner McGann.
All right, two issues. Let's have a couple questions about the $10,000 issue. We'll call it the refund. Am I right to say the committee, they're not sure where the money came from either? And to give, I mean, you've already given context, but they had an event at the convention, the hotel, credit them supposedly back $10,000 on a bill, as I understand it, and after going through the audit process, no one's really sure where the $10,000
that's correct
came from. They thought maybe it was a credit from somebody else who maybe had an event at the same hotel. And I'm sympathetic to not blaming a committee for the mistakes of hotel bills, because this happens, particularly happens around conventions. Those who have been to conventions, most of us have. Commissioners tend to go precisely to observe the chaos that ensues, and I can see this is certainly something that can happen. The question is now, what do you do about it? What's the committee's view on what to do with this $10,000?
The committee doesn't see it as an in-kind contribution. They're not quite sure. They thought it might be a refund for some event that was canceled. But at this point, when we were during our field work, this particular bill from the hotel was part of our disbursement sample. And when it was viewed, it was noted that there was a $10,000 credit given to the Minnesota DFL. Initially, we thought it might have been a prohibited contribution, because the copy of the check that was included with the invoice was from another hotel, it was from the managing partner of another hotel, and there was no other information available. So initially we thought it might have been a prohibited contribution. As we went through the audit process and other documents were made available, the other hotel indicated that they had received this check in error, and so they were transferring the funds to the hotel where the Minnesota DFL was having their events, and it got applied to their account. We did some research, and we did note that another committee had made a $10,000 payment at the same time to the other hotel, and I guess we offered that up as a possibility that, well, maybe it was from that committee and it was supposed to go in support of some event that the DFL is having at their hotel. The committee really wasn't sure. They couldn't get an answer from the other committee as to if was this it or was it not it. So, and unfortunately, we arrived at the situation where we have a $10,000 benefit to the DFL that was not reported, and it's unknown, so that's why we recommend a disgorgement to the U.S. Treasury for that amount.
And unfortunately for the committee, they're at the mercy of the hotel, this other committee, and everyone else, and they don't know the answer either. So it's $10,000 of anonymous, who knows where it came from, money. We sort of know where it came from. It came from the credit on the hotel, but tracing
correct.
It back, they weren't entitled to this credit, right? Do they agree with that? This they can't. It wasn't as if the you know, $30,000 room block, and they only spent $20,000, so they think they're owed $10,000 by the hotel. They're not making that
No, they're not. I don't think they're claiming that, you know, that it was a mistake, or that they're not entitled to the credit, or that there's really something else. The events that the DFL had at that hotel, there's, you know, we had invoices for those that covered the entire amount, and this credit was applied to, you know, to that amount. So services were provided to the committee.
So they just made 10 grand on the deal.
You could look at it that way.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the hotel in question no longer exists. It was torn down sometime after the convention. So I think that leads to part of the problem with, you know, with finding out exactly where or who provided the original $10,000 and why it was transferred to this other hotel.
That's a tough spot to be in for a committee. I didn't realize the hotel had been torn down. All right, well, moving on. The payroll account. We had a prior audit where a state party was doing something that seemed similar, where they had a what I thought of as a holding account. Some call it escrow. We do whatever terminology we want to use, where they use it for payroll purposes, and it seemed fine for the other committee. Now, this committee has a little bit different situation, as I understand it. They're sort of doing the same thing. The way I read the file, though, is they're really not doing payroll on a split. They're paying people either 100% federal or 100% non-federal.
That's correct.
Right? So it's not a question of this is an allocation account, because it's not. They're doing – so it's, to me, this case is easier. Where it gets trickier is the claim that they didn't actually have the right amount of money to pay who they needed to pay in the account, and one side may have subsidized the other impermissibly. I think that's what the issue is. But then the report gets a little murky. Maybe it's the cover. No, here's the report gets a little murky. Look at page 2 of, actually, this is the cover memo. Where they say, well, when you look at the, when you actually look back to the underlying accounts, the overpayment of the non-federal payment was off, which was potentially finding two, but they established that they didn't overfund. They seem to be saying, take a look at that. That means we didn't overfund this. And then page 2, you invoke the global perspective. So I'm not sure what we're doing here. It seems to be that the way I can read the file, that what they did adds up and is okay. You're reading the file to say that there's an issue. And I'm trying to just define so we all understand.
And in the overall concept of transfers from the non-federal to the federal account to pay for non-federal, their share of non-federal activity, in the end, taking everything into consideration, we found that they demonstrated that they did not overfund all non-federal transactions. But that's broken down. If you look strictly at allocable activity, they underfunded the allocable activity by over 100,000, but they overfunded the payroll, which is separate from the H-4 activity, and that was overfunded by over $100,000. So there's I guess that's where the balance takes place if you look at it in an overall situation.
But to get there, you seem to be saying we have to treat this as a pseudo allocation account.
As an auditor, I look at payroll as, you know, in a global perspective. In other words, one pay period. The committee the committee's payroll is made up of federal and non-federal individuals. Now, in this particular case, the DFL, for administrative reasons, decided that they would treat their employees as either 100% federal or 100% non-federal. And what they did was that if any employee worked any time during that pay period on federal activity, they were paid with 100%. Well, they were to be paid with 100% federal funds. If they did no federal activity, then they were treated as a non-federal employee. And so looking at it that particular way, then the entire payroll for that pay period is being allocated between federal activity and non-federal activity, not looking at individual persons per se, but the actual payroll of the committee. So, and since federal monies were transferred into the non-federal account and federal funds are transferred into the payroll account and non-federal funds are transferred into the payroll account to make these payments, as an auditor, I see that as allocation.
Okay, I hear you. The concern I have is I thought we already crossed that bridge in the Georgia Dem audit? The fight there was whether this sort of thing was an allocation account or not. It seems like we're still trying to say it is. I think we crossed that bridge. I understand what you're saying, where you're coming at it from an audit perspective, but as a legal perspective, I don't see this as an allocation account. And if the legal predicate is different than the one I'm not blaming you. I see what you're doing. I'm just coming at it from a different point of view.
Well, my interpretation of the regulations, a committee can have. Outlines the types of accounts that a committee can have. They can have federal accounts, allocation accounts, 11 accounts.
We're all familiar with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got it.
But
I've heard of them.
So, and again, as an auditor, a payroll account is an operating account. And
right,
it makes it difficult, even on the committee, to try and distinguish between the disbursements that are being made and to correctly report them and ensure that there's no overfunding issue and so on and so forth. So,
I would also offer in the Georgia case, I believe the one distinction was that those accounts were set up as separate accounts. It was a more of an escrow account that was held by ADP or a payroll processing company, where in this case, I believe the account was within the payroll was handled exclusively by the committee. So I don't know if that draws
any
distinction.
But I mean, so really what you're saying is I think we've already decided this in the Georgia audit, but you're saying maybe you don't think we did because this is distinguishable than Georgia. But if I said that this is like Georgia, just as from your perspective isn't wrong if you start from the premise you're starting from, right? But if I start from the premise I'm starting, I mean, I'm not wrong either by saying this. I could say this looks like the Georgia thing and move on, right? I mean, it's a question of perspective.
Right.
It's not that anyone's metaphysically correct or wrong. It seems like you guys want to keep saying this stuff's allocation, and maybe at a certain point it is, but I'm kind of buying this payroll idea. That it looks like the Georgia thing.
Right. I would just also offer that I think Georgia has changed the way that they handle their account structure now to have payroll, at least federal payroll, as a federal operating account. And Minnesota's as well.
Right. The DFL has also changed their administrative procedures. They now have a federal payroll account and a non-federal payroll account.
Yeah, I recall that with Georgia. That came up. And I think maybe some commissioners thought that was important to varying degrees or not important to other degrees. But that's still, to me, sizzle, not the steak. I mean, it seems to me this seems to be a variant of what the Georgia folks were doing, and it seems to me this is okay, because of the way they're doing payroll now. Just because they changed, they were doing it differently years ago. That doesn't make it illegal. Maybe from an auditing perspective, that that raises the antenna. And I certainly understand that, but as a legal perspective, you know, you can do it a lot of ways. You know, the Danny Lee McDonald phrase, paint it round, paint it flat, doesn't make it right. Wrong. If it's just a choice, and they chose to do their payroll this way, and I don't see a violation of the underlying legal norm.
Also, you did some research, didn't you, on how the committee has reported this account in the past? That may be
the continuance from the September 20th meeting allowed me to do a little bit more research and spend some time down with the microfish downstairs. Basically, what we found was that back in the 92 election cycle, there was a team of auditors that were out there auditing the 1990 or 88 and 1990 election cycle, and during the course of their field work, they had some discussions with the committee, and the committee amended their 91 reports to include the payroll account as a federal account and report all the transactions based on discussions that they had apparently with the audit staff that was out there at the time. And they continued to do this for some time. Now, as time went on, I did not note any 100% non-federal payroll being reported, but they appeared to switch to allocating on Schedule H-4 all the payroll. And then around the time when BCRA came into effect and the 25% rule took place, it appeared the committee stopped reporting any salary on Schedule H-4 as allocated and reported just 100% federal. So to our best estimate, this is when they quite possibly may have came up with the decision to either treat their employees as 100% federal or 100% non-federal.
That's helpful. I feel bad you had to go through the microfiche, but that's how we still keep a lot of the sacred scrolls here. It's quite a treat. But I appreciate you doing that. We've had issues in the past where committees have been audited years ago and it's gotten lost in the microfiche. So I want to thank you for doing all that. But you did in the presenting the narrative really hit the issue. I mean, what they were doing in 92 to me doesn't really matter much, because when McCain-Feingold came in, it completely changed how parties had to fund their activities and pay their employees. It used to be a pretty simple overhead ratio, and now it's much more complicated and cumbersome. And it's not surprising that they decided to go 100% federal or 100% non-federal. If the state party were to pay its 100% non-federal employee, and assume for the sake of argument that we all agree that what they're doing is 100% non-federal, they could pay that directly out of their non-federal account. Correct?
Correct.
Right. So what you're really saying is, because they're running it through this, whatever we want to call it, I'll call it a payroll account, you want to call it a sort of an analogous allocation account, that now that should have to then show up on their reports? Is that the issue?
Well, as treating it as an allocation account, federal allocation account, it would have to be reported. Now, the question would be, you know, where would it be reported? On Schedule H-4, the non-federal portion gets eliminated to come up with their total correct federal activity, federal disbursements. In this particular case, it could be possible that they could report the entire payroll in its entirety as, let's say, 45% was federal payroll, and get that total amount. 55% was non-federal payroll, and then with memo entries indicate the payments to the individuals, and they would show up either on the federal side or the non-federal side. Or the transactions could be reported on line 21. I mean, the non-federal on line 29 and the federal on 21B or 30B, depending on, you know, if there's FEA activity involved.
Assuming you're right that this is an allocation account, all that makes a lot of sense, and I don't really have any reason to disagree with all that. But I think the predicate question is, what is this account? And I just, for me, we crossed that bridge in the Georgia audit. I mean, we can keep trying to say these things are allocation accounts, but to me, this case is easier because they're not actually really allocating. They're paying 100% Fed or 100% non-Fed. Not even doing a split. I mean, there's no, well, that I'll yield.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had some concerns about the about this payroll account, and I was a little confused about the way the memo is worded. When you say they on page 2, the MNDFL did not overfund the non-federal share of overall expenses, but there were insufficient federal funds in the payroll account to pay for the total reported federal expenditures, resulting in an overfunding of the federal share of salaries and taxes by the non-federal accounts. And I think that's a little bit confusing. You know, you read that. When I first read that, I thought, it's not overfunding, but it is overfunding. I'm a little confused here. And I think there was a reference earlier to the non-federal account, but I take it, correct me if I'm wrong, there wasn't one non-federal account. We're talking about a number of different accounts.
Correct. Yes, there are several non-federal accounts.
And this payroll account is a separate account? Yes, no, maybe?
As an auditor, I find the payroll account to be an operating account. I guess the title of it's is payroll, but I mean, there are other federal accounts. They had a DFL federal checking account. They had a DFL, they had federal accounts for contributions and so
on. I'm just focusing on the payroll. This is an account?
It is a account. It is one single account. It's the same account that they had back in 1992. In fact, the account number is still the same.
It's an account that received transfers from federal accounts as well as non-federal accounts.
Okay. So they're paying all the payroll out of this one account. Money's going in from both federal and non-federal sources. And as I understand what you're saying here, at some point or at some points, there wasn't enough federal. So the non-federal was subsidizing the non-federal was subsidizing the federal payroll, correct?
Correct.
Out of that, looking exclusively at that account.
Right.
Yes.
Right, but that's,
right.
It's an account.
Right.
And that was not the case, as I recall, in the Georgia audit.
Correct.
Okay. Because I, it's very similar to the issue that we considered in Georgia. I would disagree with my colleague to the extent that he views that as having settled the issue. There were certainly three commissioners who were ready to establish a rule of law based on the Georgia audit that these kinds of payroll accounts cannot be considered allocation accounts, but there weren't four commissioners of that view. My own personal view is that there were equitable considerations in that case that warranted not making the finding, one being that they were kind of jammed by their vendor, which is also not the case here. And in that case, there truly seemed to be a no harm, no foul, because there was no subsidy of any kind of federal expenditures, payroll or otherwise, by the non-federal sources. Correct? Correct me if I'm wrong, because this stuff is complicated.
Correct.
Yes.
So I think this case is actually different. And I think that where there is this issue of subsidization, there is more of a need for more reporting so that we can track that sort of thing. So I think, you know, I thought about this a lot. I appreciate your research. I appreciate the microfiche work. You're going to need a new prescription on your eyeglasses after that. But I think that this is actually not quite the same as the Georgia audit on that issue. On the hotel bill, the fact that the hotel got burned down is really just sort of adds local color to the whole thing. How long after they were there and they got built did the hotel burn down?
It was torn down.
Torn down, okay.
It was about 2 years after the convention.
So, if they saw something in their bill that looked wrong, they did have some amount of time before the building got torn down when they could have perhaps tried to inquire. You know, how they unpack it now, I agree, makes their life a little bit more complicated, but it seems to me that they were at least on notice that they got something of value from somebody. This $10,000 credit on their bill didn't, you know, come from nowhere. And I don't think you can just say, maybe some individuals might do that if they got a credit. If their bill came out lower than they were expecting, they might say, ooh, I lucked out on that and walk away. Personally, I would go back and try and correct the billings with the hotel. But want to establish that. But, I don't think political committees have that same flexibility where they might decide, do I want to just kind of take the money and run, except this my hotel bill was lower than it was supposed to be, and just kind of go off with it. I think they actually do have a duty of inquiry at that point. So I think this is a very complicated audit, and I don't envy you for having to parse through all of this, but I think ultimately I agree with the recommendations.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also going to support the recommendations. I do have quite a bit of sympathy for the hotel bill issue, because getting an answer from a hotel can be a challenge. But this is not the $8 package of Oreos. This is a third of their total catering bill, in the tune of $10,000, and they need to be able to explain what it is, and if they can't, I think they're sort of stuck, and they're not like an individual person or maybe just a regular corporation. This is a committee that needs to be able to show that their money is permissible within the scope of federal law. So although I'm sympathetic and it's in some of this information may not be in their control when you go to check out and your bill goes from $19,000 to $9,000, you probably should have asked some questions at that point to make sure that this was a permissible credit on your account for whatever the transaction might have been. And without that, I don't know that there's much that we can do about it. So I'll support a motion to approve this report or this recommendation memo.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also agree that the Georgia FEC audit, I think that this is it is applicable to the audit we have before us. I mean, there we did have the concern from the vendor, apparent inability to process payroll from separate accounts. But here there's an administrative convenience factor as well. But similar to the Georgia FEC issue, at least what was persuasive to me was the concern about avoiding public confusion and distorting or creating a distorted impression about the extent to which, in that case, the Georgia Democratic Party was engaging in federal activity when you took all sorts of monies that were clearly had nothing to do with federal elections or the payment of employees who were involved in federal elections. That would create and really do a disservice to public understanding about what the nature of their federal involvement was. Same thing here, especially when they've kind of adopted a rule that you touch federal activity in any way, shape, or form, you're going to be paid out of the federal account, and only those who are not tainted, for lack of a better word, by involvement in federal activities, would you then be paid out of the non-federal account? So if we were to lump all of this and call it all a federal account, I think it would create on the public record a distorted view of exactly the extent to which the Minnesota party was actually involved in federal election activities. I'm still kind of hung up on a point that the vice chair brought up, which is on page 2, kind of the overfunding or, well, not overfunding issue. If you're looking at this, and this is maybe putting you on the spot, and maybe this is a little bit of a difficult thing for you to do on the fly, if you're looking at this from my perspective, that this is not an allocation account and there's not a problem with using it as a payroll account for administrative purposes, was there in fact a subsidization of federal payroll by the non-federal account when they were shifting monies? Were they shifting more non-federal into this payroll account than was justified by how they were paying their employees?
That's correct. They did. They overfunded from the non-federal account, which in effect subsidized the federal payroll.
And that's going on the assumption that they were paying each, you know, that they had all of their employees in neat boxes, one 100% non-federal and one 100% federal. There still was some subsidization that did take place?
That's correct.
And to what extent was that?
Approximately $120,000.
$120,000. Okay. And maybe it's here in this report. Where's that number listed in the report?
Get my report out.
That would be listed on page 15. Actually, I'm incorrect. That was $102,000. Okay, the $120,000 was the underfunding of shared activity reported on Schedule H-4.
Okay. And just how did the just if you, to the extent you know, when presented with this, that even under the Minnesota party's own analysis of how they were using this account and that it shouldn't be considered a federal account but a payroll account, there still was a problem with oversubsidization to the extent of $102,000. What was their reply? Did they contend against that, or did they agree
that? They agreed that there was an overfunding.
Okay. So they agreed that there was an overfunding, but they just say, but this is a little bit of a different legal analysis.
But when taken overall with all the non-federal accounts and all the federal accounts and transfers and for shared activity and so on, that, you know, the net effect was that there was no overfunding.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner McGinn.
So if you look at it overall, for the period covered by the audit, and you add in everything they did, they didn't. You can make it add up that they didn't overfund. That's their argument. But if you look at individual pay periods, they did. And what I mean by that is a simple hypothetical. You have a federal employee, a non-federal employee. They each get paid $100, and the federal account moves $100. Non-federal account moves $100. No problem there, in my view. If the non-federal account moves $150 and the federal account moves $50 and they pay each $100, you have $50 of non-federal paying the federal share.
Correct.
Right? That's what happened. That's a oversimplified version of what they did here.
As to the timing of the overfunding, you know, I couldn't give you a specific time without going back and, you know, reviewing records and so on. So. But for the entire election cycle, there was an overfunding.
Do you have a sense, was it consistent throughout the cycle that they were off most pay periods, or was it a handful? Or you may not know, because I'm getting into the details here, and I thought the issue was a bigger question of law, but factually, the vice chair did kind of put it in the light that, and then Commissioner Peterson brought it home, that we all agree the report, the memo is confusing. It's just the deep, trying to make sure we all agree on what the issue is.
I have a worksheet here where I went through it and looking at the payroll account. Now, bear in mind the timing issues as to were they pre-funding their payroll or did they have an existing balance that they were carrying forward into the next payroll and funding it after they made the payments. All of that taken into effect makes it does have some effect. I'll just take one. Well, let's see. In the, I'll take July of 2007. They transferred approximately $58,000 from their federal account and $26,000 from their non-federal account. The salaries were $29,000 federal, $21,000 non-federal. Taxes were $15,000 federal, $9,000 non-federal, and there was a small amount of money paid to their retirement vendor. And they were left, the ending balance in the account was down $46,000, and they had started with just $400,000. That was the way that I did my analysis. It was on the actuality of the checks clearing, you know, the payroll checks clearing through the bank account. And as we ran through, so based on the total payroll, federal and non-federal taxes and other, you know, disbursements, this is where I came up with the overfunding.
Okay. On the entry you talked about there, I didn't write down the numbers as you were going. Could you give us the rough? Rough delta, the difference on what the overfunding was there, because I can't,
without having a calculator in front of me, I can't say that they overfunded in that particular month. I just was looking at one month. I was just trying to show you how I went about what my procedure was when I was determining what the payroll was and what the funding issues were.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a follow-up question on this issue just to make sure I completely understand. So there was an overfunding of the non-federal payroll. It seems like a subsidization issue would arise if there was a corresponding underfunding on the federal payroll side. I mean, if there wasn't an underfunding on federal payroll but an overfunding of non-federal payroll, then I'm not sure that there would necessarily be a subsidization problem. There would just be an extra $102,000.
Well, there was an underfunding on the federal side.
And yes. And to what extent was it underfunded on the federal side?
It was approximately $110,000.
$110,000? Yeah. Okay. So those are not exactly the same, but they're pretty – they balance each other out.
Pretty much balance each other out. Okay. Now, there was the committee did make a statement in their response to the DFAR, and there was an ending balance on December 31st, 2008 in the account. And of that balance, there was a $116,000 balance in the account. And $101,000 of that balance was federal dollars. Only $15,000 came from the non-federal account.
Okay.
Now, I used those amounts when I was determining the over and underfunding. So the over and underfunding amounts are still the same because it includes that $100,000 that was transferred in from the federal accounts. And if you recall, after the 2008 election, there was a recount going on in Minnesota. So most of the federal monies was for the recount, and they had a fairly large staff of employees that were hired specifically for during the recount.
Okay, and just one further point of clarification: the fourth number in the column on page 15, reported federal activity paid from non-federal accounts. What, that 8,000, that's not the difference between the 110 we're talking about,
no.
The underfunded. Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
No, that was separate activity paid out of the non-federal that they agreed was did have a federal component to it.
Okay.
And this was the federal share of that.
Okay. But for our purposes, we have an overfunding of 102 and an under on the non-federal side and an underfunding on the federal payroll side of 110, which roughly balance each other out and result in some subsidization. Okay, thank you.
I just want to clarify one point. Finding one as written, though, still, if the commission were to approve that, it would mean this payroll account is a federal account.
Yes.
And in the Georgia audit, the conclusion of the commission was not that their payroll account was a federal account, right? We didn't.
My reading of on the Georgia account was that there was no decision made as to what type of account the payroll account was, only that the committee did not have to report the non-federal transactions.
And if it were a federal account, it would have to report the non-federal transactions. Right, because everything in the federal account would be reported.
Correct.
So, given the commission said they didn't have to report it, that means the commission's implicitly the predicate to that is that it's not a federal account. But here we're saying this one is. So, if you approve this audit report as is, particularly finding one, you are saying it's a federal account, which, in my view, is the opposite of what the commission said in Georgia. I think.
Mr. Calvert, do you have a comment on that?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. In our legal comments, I want to try to tie some of this together and maybe go to the point that Commissioner McGann is trying to make. We went back and listened to the tape in Georgia, and we were unable to determine, because commissioners had multiple rationales for what they were doing, whether the commission was doing a rule of was essentially making a rule of law, saying no, you can do this sort of payroll account, and it's not a federal account. You don't have to ever report anything, or whether what the commission was saying was, well, this particular committee, this Georgia committee, there was no overfunding. They were absolutely clean. So, as an act of administrative discretion. Not as a determination that this isn't a federal account or isn't the functional equivalent of an allocation account, but as a matter of no harm, no foul, we're not going to require this committee to report. And it wasn't a clean split because all of those rationales were important to a variety of commissioners. So the analysis we have in our comments on this audit basically boils down to this. If what the commission was saying in the Georgia audit is that this sort of an account is fine and it's not a federal account, you don't have to report the 100% non-federal part of it, then you're right. This is just like Georgia. But one of the things that we had pointed out in our comments in Georgia was that the reason for the rule that you got to report every penny in and every penny out, even all the non-federal, of accounts in which we allow you to mix the money is so that we can have a look and make sure that you're not engaging in any impermissible subsidization or overfunding. There wasn't any impermissible overfunding or subsidization in Georgia, so maybe that was an act of administrative discretion. And we were just pointing out that this case maybe more clearly delineates that choice of, there is some reason that we were advocating in Georgia that you've got to report even the 100% non-federal in a situation like this if the money is mixed. And depending on whether you put more emphasis on the net overfunding of this payroll account or the overall underfunding of the committee's total operations, then that may or may not make a difference to you as to where you come out ultimately on the relationship between this audit and the Georgia audit, and whether that one was an ironclad rule of law or an exercise of administrative discretion.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not to endlessly belabor this point, I understand where my colleagues are coming from, but I just want to point out that in the Georgia case, while the original recommendation failed, the original recommendation from the auditors failed by a vote of 2-4, and I was within that 4. So that meant that 4 commissioners didn't go along with what was originally recommended. But then there were several subsequent motions. There was a motion to find that the payroll escrow account was not an allocation account, and that failed 3-3. There was a motion to these motions are so dense. There was a motion to find that the commission doesn't have jurisdiction to impose record-keeping and documentation requirements on employee activity that a state party claims is solely non-federal, and that also failed 3-3. So while the original recommendation didn't pass on a 4-2 vote or a 2-4 vote, the attempts to, you know, sort of declare what the rationale was and get a consensus on it, those didn't work either. Those failed. So I think that's why counsel is left in this, well, we're not sure exactly what happened there, position. And as the person who was sort of the swing vote on that, as I said earlier, I think counsel's description of it as an act of administrative discretion based on the facts of that case, I think, is fairly accurate. And I think this case points out that there are circumstances in which that act of administrative discretion might not be appropriate because of this issue of the subsidy, which, you know, some people think there was a subsidy, some people think there wasn't, but, you know, some of us at least think that there was something that was that the public would have an interest in seeing disclosed. So that's sort of how we end up in this mushy place.
Thank you very much for the conversation and the information that you pulled. It was a very helpful conversation. But I think at this point it's probably best to hold this over to consider all the information and the discussion here at the table. Thank you very much. Sorry to do this to you, but we're gonna move the order around a little bit on the agenda, unless there's an objection to that. We're going to move past the audit for right now. We'll come back to it, and we're going to talk about consideration of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, the order in the Van Hollen v. FEC matter. And the reason for that is to accommodate somebody's schedule. We're going to attempt to consider this before 11:55. If we have to, we can always break for lunch and then come back and finish talking about Van Hollen. Then we'll talk next about the Right March audit and then hear about the candidate and committee viewer demonstration. So regarding the Van Hollen decision, just a very brief overview about how we got to where we are today. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, as you may know, filed a complaint in April of last year challenging the commission's regulation, which was promulgated in 2007, concerning the disclosure of contributors for persons making electioneering communications. The United States District Court for the District of Columbia in March of this year found that the Commission Regulation 11 CFR 104.20 C9 was invalid. The court held that that regulation was the one that called for all the disclosure of donations made for the purpose of furthering electioneering communications, and the court struck that regulation. A month later, two interveners intervened and then later filed a notice of appeal. The interveners are Hispanic Leadership Fund and the Center for Individual Freedom. In April of this year, the FEC filed a notice that it would not appeal the court's March 30th order. On April 27th of this year, the district court vacated the regulation at issue and reinstated the commission's prior regulation on this matter, which took effect in December of 2002. On September 18th, so just a few weeks ago, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia reversed the decision in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia and remanded the case with instructions to refer the matter to the FEC for further consideration. On September 20th of this year, the District Court directed the Commission to inform the Court by October 12th whether the Commission, quote, intends to pursue rulemaking or defend its current regulation. So the reason that we're discussing this today and we intend to hold a vote on whether to pursue a rulemaking is because the court has ordered us to do so, and obviously that decision will be made public in the FEC's filing to the court, which again is due by October 12th of this year. So with that, is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
I do have a motion, but I also have an explanation for the motion. We're sort of in an unusual posture, but it is a rulemaking motion. We do those in open session, the court has given us a choice here and has asked whether we're going to do a rulemaking, and I think that's what we should do. The appellate court said that the rule that we're talking about is basically, they said, it's unworkable and confusing. They said the rule has raised as many questions as it purported to resolve. And then they say, so do you want to take another crack at this and do a rulemaking to address this, or do you want to defend the rule as it is? It seems to me that when the court's already told us that we've got a confusing rule that's raised as many questions as it's resolved, to then go back to the court and say, no, we just like it the way it is, we're going to defend it as is, strikes me as the wrong choice. I think there are three reasons why we should do a rulemaking, one being that, as I just said, the court has already said, and I think a lot of people have found, that this rule is not what we hoped it would be. It did not provide clarity. In fact, quite the opposite. Secondly, I think we know more now than we knew in 2007 when we adopted this rule. It was what we've got left here is a fragment of a rulemaking. Most of the rulemaking that was done in 2007 in the wake of Wisconsin Right to Life decision has been struck down. We did that rulemaking quickly. I think it was concluded just as several commissioners' terms were about to unfortunately expire and the commission was about to lose its quorum, and perhaps we rushed that through imprudently. But this is the last fragment of it that's left over. And it was not the major issue in the rulemaking. We now have data about how the rule has worked. There's a report from Public Citizen, for example, that analyzed our data and also drew upon analyses that were done by the Center for Responsive Politics and found that the percentage of group disclosing the financiers of their ads fell from nearly 100% before Wisconsin Right to Life to less than 50% in 2008 and to just over a third in what was then the recently completed election cycle, 2010. Collectively, in 2010, groups making electioneering communications disclosed the sources of only $17.3 million or dollars or 23.3% of their $74.3 million in electioneering communications spending. And of the top 10 EC groups in 2010, just 10.8% of the money that they spent was disclosed by donor. So we know how the rule has been working, and it has not been working to promote disclosure. It's been working to undermine disclosure. The rule was supposed to implement a provision that promotes disclosure. So it could not have been, and I know because I was there, it was not the intent of the commission to undermine the provision that it was trying to implement. It just hasn't worked very well. And it's, you know, the commission was concerned about some, you know, that there are, and I still believe that there are, and we receive comments on this, folks who give to organizations for reasons that are totally unrelated to the political messages that those organizations put forward and to the ads that they run. But this rule has been interpreted in a way that organizations now seem to feel comfortable saying, okay, we're going to run a lot of ads. In fact, we're going to tell you we're going to run millions of dollars of ads, but we're not going to tell you, Mr. Donor, exactly which ad or your donations are going to support or whether your particular money is going to support any ads at all. We're just going to take all this money and we're going to use it to run the ads. And they seem to think that that exempts them from disclosing the donors. But I don't think, as I said, that's certainly not what I intended. I don't think that's what the commission intended, but that's the way it's being interpreted, and that's why we ought to change it. And the Supreme Court seems to get this. I mean, the underlying premise, the reason that we even addressed disclosure at all in that rulemaking was that there was a sense by a number of folks, including some on the commission at the time, that Wisconsin Right to Life was the first hurdle, and then the next decision was clearly going to knock down the disclosure rules along the same lines that the funding restrictions were being knocked down. And this shows the, I think, fallacy of commissioners predicting where they think the courts are going to go, because in Citizens United, the court actually took the exact opposite approach and said that it's really important, not just constitutional, but really important to disclose the donors. And and to provide disclosure of these ECs. We're now seeing races where the outside spending is exceeding the spending by the candidates, and I think we're going to see that more and more. So, again, finding out who's behind the ads is important to an informed electorate, and the Supreme Court has recognized this. The there's an example that I could provide from ripped from the Daily Headlines. In my home state of Maryland, there's an initiative about a casino, about casino building, and there's two groups that are running ads. One, the casino builders themselves are supporting it, and they're saying it's going to bring jobs and education. But then there's another group, which is named something vague like No on Question 7, I think it is, that's running ads saying, no, it's not going to bring jobs, and it's not going to the money's not going to go to education. And I thought, sort of to echo Butch Cassidy, for the movie buffs out there, who are those guys? Who are the guys who are running the ads against this initiative? And I found out in the newspaper, assuming that I can believe what I read in the newspaper, that actually those ads are not being run by folks who are concerned about jobs or education in Maryland. It's being run by some folks who have a competing casino in West Virginia, and they don't want people to be going to casinos in Maryland. They want them to come to their casino in West Virginia. And that affects how I credit those ads, knowing who's funding them and what their motivations are. And I think that that's why it's important to find out this information. Like I said, the Supreme Court recognized it. The data shows the rule is not working the way it was intended. And I could go on at some more length, but I recognize that one of my colleagues would like to vote on this motion before going to lunch. So let me move that we initiate a rulemaking to address the rules governing disclosure of electioneering communications by corporations and labor unions, direct the general counsel to inform the district court that the commission is pursuing this rulemaking as required by the court's order of September 20th, 2012, and direct the office of the general counsel to prepare a draft notice of proposed rulemaking for the commission's consideration. I think everything should be on the table. We should be open to considering. I'd be happy to do an advance notice of proposed rulemaking if that would assist my colleagues and maybe gather more ideas from the public even in advance of putting out the notice. I'd be happy to throw in corporate facilitation, an issue that I know that you all are interested in seeing in a rulemaking context. I'd be happy to throw that one in, too, as a sweetener. But I do think that given that what the court has said, what the appellate court has said, what the Supreme Court has said, what the data has shown about this rule, we should pursue this rulemaking rather than just going back to court and defending the rule that's been on the books.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. I'm going to support this motion, but I fear that the third time will not be the charm for this regulation. Those of you who have been following the agency closely know that after Citizens United in January of 2011, the Vice Chair, Commissioner Walther, and I supported an NPRM to address a number of regulations affected by CU, including this one. We tried again later in 2011 to revisit this reporting regulation on a scaled-back version, along with a couple of others. And we're again unsuccessful. And I'd hope that in the face of an appellate court telling us that this regulation raises more questions than it answers, and conceding that neither the court nor the parties understand even a part of this particular regulation, that we would be able to move forward on this today. I believe that neither the public nor those who report under this regulation are served by ignoring these important issues. And I have a little more to say on that, but I know we want to move things along, so I'll yield for now and support this motion.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'll just add that I support the comments of my colleagues on this, and I think we should go ahead on this. And frankly, I think we ought to try and have a more broad rulemaking at some time in the near future.
Okay. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. The motion fails 3-3, and since the motion failed, the commission will proceed in defending the current regulation, which is the normal course, the normal practice of the commission. Thank you. We will now recess the open meeting for lunch and reconvene at 2 p.m. Open session. It's back in session. We will now consider Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on rightmarch.com PAC. A09-25.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, all. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on rightmarch.com PAC, Inc., which recommends you approve the three findings as presented in the draft final audit report. For the first finding, the Statement of Financial Activity, the committee has not amended its reports to correct the misstatements. For the second finding, extension of credit by a commercial vendor, the draft audit final audit report notes that the commercial vendor did not make an impermissible extension of credit to the committee. However, the committee continues to dispute the need to disclose debts arising from the weekly invoices. For the third finding, failure to file notices and properly disclose independent expenditures in response to the DFAR, the committee stated that it has disputed this issue throughout the audit process, including a request for early consideration by the committee commission, and we are prepared to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Any comments? Commissioner McGinn?
The failure to disclose debt issue, I don't agree on that one. The committee's response, I think, answers the question. The issue is whether these weekly statements that were provided were actually something that looked more like invoices that then created debt, or are they, as the committee says, they specify the maximum possible amount that political advertising could receive from Right March for its services if the fundraising program was particularly successful. Part of this comes from my own experience. To me, this is essentially a weekly or a periodic status report letting you know how the prospecting is doing. It doesn't create debt because it's all contingent upon other terms in the contract. And to me, the way I read this sort of deal, this is not something that causes debt, at least reportable debt, to occur. And really for the reasons that the committee through counsel gives, that's why I think the finding, I can't support that part of the finding. Before we go to the other parts of the audit, maybe I'll yield back and see if anyone else has thoughts on that point so we keep it kind of in order.
Any other thoughts on that point? Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share the same concerns. In this particular, we, in the report, we accept the, it appears the auditors accept the argument that this was, you know, the way that they do business in this sort of an arrangement, that this was not a contract that was unusual, that this was typical in the field. And if this truly were a situation where we had debt, it would seem in that case that the vendor would be the one saying, you owe me a lot of money. But they're the ones saying that, you know, this is, as Commissioner McGann said, that these were just statements that they said were otherwise misleading, because all they were saying was that they represented the maximum possible amounts that PA, which was the vendor, could earn if the telemarketing campaign were exceptionally successful. So to then use those amounts as the amount and subtract from that the amount that was actually paid by Right March, I think leads to a pretty misleading number, or a number that doesn't really have a great deal of meaning. So I agree. I can't support this finding either. I think that what both the vendor and the what the audited committee here, Right March, the information they set forward, I find persuasive that this wasn't a no-risk contract. They set forth information, the vendor does, that this was a profitable contract for them, both in terms of actual money that they made from it, and also in terms of the value of the names that they were able to obtain through the course of the contract as well. So with regard to the second finding, I too am not going to be able to support it.
Mr. Walther,
I'd be interested in the staff comments on the issue raised so far, on the debt issue. As the contract progressed, was it more and more likely that the debt was being incurred because, in fact, there was, you know, it's being made? How did you view that?
We considered the documentation that we had similar to invoices and calculated the debt that way, and this is consistent with previous treatment of similar debt issue, for instance, like in CLPAC in the past. So we've approached this issue the same way before.
And can you kind of fill me in on that previous precedent?
On CLPAC?
I mean, I would also add that, you know, when we took the weekly statements and considered them invoices, we did with what we do with any other debt, and considered them to be reportable as of the time that the reports were due, as of that time period. The regulations also allow for a committee to estimate the debts, even if the amount of debt is disputed or whatnot. So, I mean, that was kind of our thought process.
I gather you could report contingent or something like that, a contingent debt based upon other things. Do you require that sometimes or recommend it?
I mean, I think the regulations stipulate just estimated debts. So whether that's contingent on other things happening, I think that's up for interpretation. But it does allow for estimating debts and putting those on your scheduled day.
I guess the question is if there's a potential increase in a debt, but it may not be. What do you recommend they put, whether it is truly contingent or something along that line?
Yeah, that you could put...
it could be misleading, too, unless you had some kind of qualifying language.
Oh, I think there's room on the reports to do something like that, sure.
Commissioner McGann?
Steve's done.
I'm not sure if you're... Okay.
CLPAC case, I think, was a no-risk contract. I think that's distinguishable here. I'm not sure the precedent actually says this result is preordained. I think there's plenty of other precedent that goes the other way. Some of it was on split votes. Some, I think, had not split votes on these sorts of contracts. And there certainly is that one MER with a penalty that was paid, but that was a no-risk contract. You had a vendor essentially fronting a lot of money for a program that really they shouldn't have been doing, which is different than this contract. And I think this contract is much more in line with the sort of thing that is okay, and I think addresses the concerns raised in the – if we're assuming we're talking about the same case. I don't remember the respondent. I'm assuming it's the same body of precedent. If it is contingent debt, that doesn't have to be reported. What has to be reported is debt or estimated debt, but that presupposes there's a debt under this contract. It's not a debt. It's you don't have to report what might be a debt someday. It's debt, and whether you know the amount or not is then the question. If you know the amount, you report the debt. If you don't, you estimate it because you know you owe somebody something. Here, that's not the case. This is distinguishable from that, and I don't see how you could do something on the reports that's not required by the rule. Because it actually is, as Commissioner Walter sort of alludes to, ends up being confusing if you're showing contingent debt that's not really debt. I mean, it's tough enough to estimate, but that, again, assumes that there's debt. So the point Commissioner Walter's making, I think, is if I'm hearing it right, is spot on. And it really turns on, to me, what the contract says. And I think under this contract, this wasn't debt. Now, you think these look like invoices. They sort of look like invoices, but once you look at the contract and go through it from my perspective, they're not invoices. They're more like status reports, so you know what's going on. That's not the same as debt. Potentially, it could become debt someday if a bunch of things happen, but under contract law, that's not debt. That's all contingencies, and until it's debt, you don't have to report it.
Mr. Calvert.
Thank you. I did just want to point out in response to Commissioner McGann that, and my colleagues in the audit division can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe I remember this, that this was actually described in the text of the contract itself as a no-risk guarantee. And the difficult thing about this in terms of the reporting is that in the relevant precedent, there have been some of these arrangements that have been disapproved. There's some of them that have been approved, but we've always treated them as extensions of credit. And extensions of credit, I think in every instance I'm aware of, has meant that you've got to report something. The theoretical basis for why they didn't have to report anything is that they didn't owe anything. And if they didn't owe anything and weren't ever going to owe anything, then you kind of get back into the loop of, well, how is this not a contribution because you're providing a whole lot of services for this committee and not ever going to charge them anything for it? We treated this, or in our analysis, consistent with the previous MERS, treated this essentially as an extension of credit that was repaid. It had a number of safeguards, which some of the previous precedent talks about. This is one of the few times we've had somebody in one of these cases present a record of similar practices in the industry. But ultimately, it paid for itself, and under CLPAC and some of the other precedents, if it hadn't paid for itself, I think we might be in a different position.
Mr. Bonowitz?
I just want to add that the contract itself seems to describe this weekly document as an invoice, because it states in the contract that the cost of production, stationery, and some other costs, as well as the cost of renting an improvising list, shall be added to the contingency fee stated on the weekly invoice. And that's in the contract.
It's still a contingency fee, though. If you actually look at the contract, it's called an invoice as shorthand for statement of contingency fees. So they do use the term invoice, but that's as a shorthand to make the contract easier to read. Again, I think it turns on the contract, and the way I read this contract, it's not a no risk. If it didn't work, I mean, it did pay for itself, which I think is different than what I think of as a no risk contract.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Walther?
Would it be then correct to say this would be really a case of first impression? Or suppose we were to say this is a contingency contract, and I'd like to take another look at it because I really wasn't focusing quite on that at the time or how it came about, but do you have any? I see in here you cite MER 5069 and 5132. Again, I haven't looked at those, so
those are in
was there a situation where it's contingent, but because of the lapse of time, some of it is becoming true debt and some of it's still contingent? In other words, certain facts occur to the point where part of the amount that's contingent no longer is, but some still is. How would it work? I mean, just whatever your analysis might be on that.
I'll take a stab at that. I think at this point in time, and we don't have information from the committee, and Rhonda can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the contract ran through the middle of 2012.
August 15th.
So the contract may, in fact, have ended, and based on that and the situation, they may not be required to report debt at that point, according to the contract. So, but I don't have any information. I'm just speculating. They haven't reported debt. They stopped reporting the debt the end of 2012. They did stop reporting all debt on their disclosure reports. I'm sorry, 2008. Starting 2009, they dropped the reporting of all debt.
Mr. Calvert?
Madam Chair, Ms. Foreman has some information about relevant precedent that may go to Commissioner Walther's concern.
One of the concerns, I guess, that was raised, I believe, by Commissioner Walther was whether we have precedent in other MERS or other matters that addressed what could be contingent, what could be considered contingent debt or a debt that may or may not occur. We do have a situation, and we did cite it in our comments regarding MER 4742 Juan Vargas for Congress. And in that particular matter, the committee would pay a portion of what they owed, and then the rest would be considered deferred compensation. A portion of that deferred compensation that both parties agreed would be payable only if both parties agreed that the committee could afford to pay it at a later time.
That's still a debt.
Ultimately, the commission decided not to pursue it as an in-kind contribution, but decided that it was a reportable debt.
I can see if that particular contingency is not the kind I'm thinking of, where, oh, well, I can't pay it, therefore it was contingent all the way along. It's if it's if they can afford it, then it's a legal document. But that I'm thinking more in terms of something that's the contingency is not in the control of the people who actually for whom it's contingent. So but I'm just trying to...
I suppose
get the,
one example that,
that analysis thought through.
I suppose one example, this may or may not be what you were considering, but there's also an advisory opinion, the Calvert advisory opinion that we also cite in our analysis, in which it involved a disputed debt, so it's a slightly different circumstances, but that would be a situation where it was out of the committee's control to a certain extent. They still were required to report the outstanding debt until finally the commission in the advisory opinion advised them that they could report and the amount that was in dispute. They finally let them off the hook, but they were required to report it until that point in time.
But it's fairly clear that if there's a dispute, then you have to report it, don't you think? I mean, at least you have a party who's contending it's a legal obligation. And at that point, it seems to me, presently a legal obligation, at that point, it seems to me that would, our law is fairly clear now on that. No, maybe not.
The way we interpreted this was that basically there was an extension of credit. The extension of credit is reportable as a debt, and that until the debt is no longer there, and that in this particular case, if the committee could not. If they were not uncertain of the exact amount they were required to estimate, which is also a requirement of the regulations, we would interpret that the estimated amount is the full amount that was disclosed on these weekly invoices, and that once it came to a point where it became profitable to cover all of these contingent debts, as some is referred to, the contingency fee as it's referred in the contract, then the committee would be able to either go back and amend the report under the regulations or file appropriate reports at that time disclosing that situation. The same goes when the contract terminated in August 2012.
Any other questions or comments? I believe Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on finding three as well. For clarification, this group, it sounds like, originally before they had counsel on board, reported almost all of these communications that are at issue as independent expenditures, and that the problem was that they were using the payment date rather than the dissemination date as the date for reporting those on their quarterly reports. They did have some problems with 24 and 48 hour reports, but in terms of that these things were disclosed as IEs on the regular quarterly reports with an improper date of dissemination. But that as we got into the audit, once they were represented by counsel, they made the argument that those shouldn't have been reported as IEs in the first place because these were solicitations. They weren't. They didn't actually qualify as IEs. Is that a correct summation of where they are?
That's correct.
Okay. Is there any indication that were there any things that were not reported as IEs that the auditors determined should have been reported as independent expenditures?
In the report, the only other thing we note relative to reporting independent expenditures is that that they should have reported some of those as debts, and then memo schedules. They didn't do that.
Which arises from the fact that they were using the wrong date, since they were reporting them as. Pursuant to the date of payment rather than date of dissemination, they weren't disclosing them early enough, and that's where the problem arose, right?
The weekly invoice fees.
As far as the 24 and 48-hour notices, I think the problem really boiled down to September of 2007 because of the problem with the dissemination dates not being used, but the payment date being used by the committee. Is that correct?
Yes. For the notices, right.
Okay. So then it really comes down to... our argument is you reported them correctly. That the auditor's argument is that you reported them correctly, just in terms of that you reported them, you categorized them correctly as independent expenditures, but you reported them incorrectly in terms of the dates used, and that kind of cascaded into reporting issues and memo entries and all that. They come back and say, yeah, we reported them incorrectly. They concede that, but for different reasons. We reported them incorrectly because they should have been considered operating expenditures because these were solicitation communications, not actual express advocacy communications. Okay. And which then, I guess, leads us into an issue that, you know, the commission really does have to resolve, which is whether or not these were the scripts were express advocacy. And these sorts of communications are oftentimes pretty tricky. I mean, when are these primarily solicitations? Are these looking for money, or are these advocacy pieces? And I think we've talked in the past, and I've expressed in the past that a solicitation can't necessarily inoculate itself from being an IE just by merely putting you could have a pure express advocacy piece, and then at the end, and please send us money, and then say and then take that out of the independent expenditure realm. But on the other hand, when a piece is really about give me money and we want to spend money for a variety of different things. And especially in a case like this, where it appears that the pieces were, and from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the vast majority of these communications were made in 2007.
Correct.
Okay. I believe that counsel said that 93% of the calling scripts were used in 2007. The issue, the subject of these scripts was the issue of immigration policy, and focuses on that, asks for money repeatedly, and then at the end ask a listener to tell friends to oppose Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or both or one or the other, and then what do we do with that? I think it is useful to. And they claim that, you know, that they never referred to any candidacy, that these were done well away from any elections. And so we're left to wonder, what does oppose mean? Now, oppose can be a magic word, but you also have to look at the internal context of the actual communication. What are they asking you to oppose? Are they asking you to oppose an election, or is the communication asking you to oppose the policy efforts of particular individuals? This was certainly a live issue in 2007 and 2008. In 2007, there was a vote on then President George Bush's immigration bill in June of that year, and then there were also subsequent votes regarding the DREAM Act in October of 2007, and then early in 2008 there were votes on employer sanctions, and I believe that there was another vote on expanding the construction of a fence along the southern border of the United States. So this was a very hot issue at the time, and there was a lot of legislative activity going on in Congress. And in light of that, that's if we want to peek outside the context of the four corners of the actual communication, which I don't think is necessary in this case, but it's to the extent we want to, that is relevant context. But I think that in the communication itself, they certainly flirt with the line, and you know, the oppose language with respect to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, certainly the most reasonable interpretation, you know, may be that it was that it was to oppose their candidacies, to defeat their candidacies, but I'm not sure that that's the only reasonable interpretation. I think that when you look at it in the context, the internal context of the communication itself, it could also be read to say to oppose the efforts of those particular lawmakers. And for that reason, I'm not sure that they're wrong in saying that these really were fundraising pieces, and they were fundraising pieces that were issue-centered. They certainly, I will not disagree that these don't flirt dangerously close to the line. And they do use words that are in 100.22A, but I don't think that that's the end of the analysis, because those words can often be used in ways like especially support and oppose that can mean something other than support or oppose someone for election or oppose that person for election, that it can mean something very different if the overall piece of the communication is a legislative piece and talking about an issue such as illegal immigration. So I think there is another read of this that can, again, it may not be the most reasonable ad, but the most reasonable read, but that's not what that's not how the regulation governs this sort of a situation. It governs whether or not there is a reasonable alternative read of these ads, and I think that there is.
Madam Vice Chair?
Seriously. We're looking at ads that say, scripts that say, "We're working to defeat politicians like Hillary Clinton. Please tell your friends to oppose Hillary Clinton." How could they possibly make it more explicit? How do you defeat politicians like Hillary Clinton other than, it doesn't say we're working to defeat her policies. It says we're working to defeat politicians like Hillary Clinton. You really gotta, I don't think it can be done, honestly. I do not think there's a credible argument for that language that it is anything but express advocacy. You know, when you're in the words that are literally in 100.22A and that's not good enough for you, is there another construction of vote for? Does it have to say vote? That's not what the regulation says. I just think you're like, you're just beyond any reasonable interpretation here. I mean, you know, you want to vote that way, fine, but I'm not seeing it.
Mr. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's change the context. What if this is a piece that is sent out, or a communication that is sent out a month after the election? Still express advocacy? There's no possible. I mean, here we are. This was well over a year before an election. Support or oppose can't have any other meaning in a particular context than support or oppose somebody for election, when there's nothing else in here that signals candidacy, that signals upcoming elections. If this is a month after an election, there's no other way to read that.
We're working to defeat politicians like Hillary Clinton? No, I don't think there's any other way to read that. People are constantly running for re-election. You know, your friends in the House would tell you they're always in cycle.
Sure.
Any other questions or comments? I believe that Commissioner McGann has a motion to remove certain portions, but wanted to ask if there was a other motion first.
There is, Madam Chair. I move approval of the Audit Division recommendation set forth in the memorandum on rightmarch.com, PAC A09-25, Agenda Document 12-65.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? No.
I haven't voted on it. I support the motion, except I would like to read a little more about the contingency fee. Some of those were, that's the only thing I'd like to read. I mean, I don't know if we want to segregate it or get these votes out of the way, and that's fine with me. I support the rest of the recommendation. So, thank you. Do you want to sever it or can move this thing along? But I just have... looking at it, I haven't looked at those supporting MERS and stuff, too.
And that issue is in finding two. So perhaps...
one and three, I guess.
So perhaps you'd be willing to... Or we could just vote on this and then have a follow-up one with just one and three. Okay. So all those in favor... Let's just start over. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
For one and three.
No, this one's for the whole thing.
There's the whole thing. We'll have another one.
We'll have another one for you. So
I'll oppose it for the moment.
Okay. And so that would be all those in favor, all those no is four. So the motion fails 2-4. Is there another motion? Madam Vice Chair?
I move approval of findings 1 and 3 in agenda document 12-65.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion fails 3-3. Is there another motion? Commissioner McCann.
I move that the commission approve finding 1 and the appropriate motion is a move finding 3 to other issues and make any edits to conform that with that disposition.
And not address finding 2 in your motion?
No, I thought we were leaving that for another day, right?
Right? Just
or later, right?
I think that's right. I just wanted
only
to make sure.
My concerns 1 and 3.
Yeah. Question.
Madam Vice Chair?
I'm wondering if what we're doing makes sense because we're not going to be able to resolve it. And we're going to have to come back to this anyway.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm just not sure what we're accomplishing here.
We're trying to move all findings except for finding 2 for now. And then we just have to deal with finding 2 later.
Another procedural question?
Yes.
We don't actually have to vote on finding 3 anymore. If it's split, it's split. It goes to additional issues under 7.
That's true. That's a good point.
So it seems to me if there's... But I agree with the Vice Chair. It seems procedurally, if we have to hold this over to another open meeting, then perhaps we should... If we tried to move the whole document, that didn't work. If there are other motions, you might want to find out where they might go if they're going to split or if they're not before we start taking votes on the other pieces.
Is it possible to understand that it would either be 4-2 or 3-3 and then maybe have a tally vote at some point? Meaning that we wouldn't have to hold it to a meeting if I wanted to send in a vote one way or the other. I mean, I don't know how you want to do it.
Could, or...
I'm not sure that...
You know, we may want to still talk about it in an open meeting. It's an audit. We may have to, and, you know, I may want to keep working on you. In the open meeting. But, I mean, 2 is not... It's not a preordained conclusion on where we are in 2, because... You want to read the contract and look at the details, and that's great because of this turns on what the contract says. You know, maybe it says maybe it doesn't say what I think it says, but maybe it says something that gets you thinking it's different than other MERS. So that's, I mean, it's not easy stuff, but maybe the real question, why are we moving part of it if we know we're going to move the rest later anyway? I don't know why are we doing that?
Well, we held over the other audit, so let's hold over this one as well and discuss it at the next meeting. All righty.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Are we going to leave Commissioner McGann's motion on the table?
Do you want to withdraw your motion for now?
No.
Okay, then yes.
It gives us a place to start the
there
next
you go.
Meeting, right?
Yeah.
So
thank you.
So we don't get up here and fumble around. We need to at least know what's on the table.
Just a procedural question. Can we adjourn a meeting with a motion pending? I'm not sure we can.
I've not got my sources of information here with me, but I don't think it's... I'm not sure that it's necessarily a problem. It would be... the motion would be the pending business when the matter was returned to.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I think it's improperly a motion to table.
All right, well, I don't want to make it easy and withdraw the motion because we know we're never going to vote on finding one at some point and agree on that. So
the motion is withdrawn.
Just keep this simple.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All righty. Well, believe it or not, we are finally going to do the candidate and committee viewer demonstration. And thank you for your patience. We had to hold this over from the last meeting, and we're getting this a little later than we anticipated today, but thank you. We want to thank Paul Clark, Wei Liu, Jeff Chumley, the Information Division, and the RAD Division, and Public Disclosure for all of your hard work on this. We've already launched the portal a few weeks ago, but we've received a lot of very positive feedback already. So thank you very much. And at this time, we'll move to the audience so we can take a look.
This demo is going to be very short, maybe 10 minutes. We have a two-minute introduction of video that was done by Alex and then Jeff is going to go through the demo and show you some of the unique features that we now have that we didn't have before. And please feel free to ask questions as we go through this process. And any suggestions you may have for the next version would be helpful.
The Federal Election Commission has released a new interactive search engine called the Candidate Committee Viewer. The Candidate Committee Viewer is the agency's next phase in development of its larger campaign finance disclosure portal. The portal combines new and existing disclosure systems to make a fast and intuitive one-stop shop for campaign finance data. The viewer follows the same approach by creating informative, data-driven profiles of searchable candidates, committees, and other regulated entities. In the past, one might have to spend hours scrolling through files, printing out reports, paging through records, highlighting transactions, and adding up thousands of numbers to come up with the same information supplied in seconds by the viewer. It blends the best elements of several older display systems and fuses them into a quicker, more flexible, and powerful tool. This system gives the user choices among various queries, including reports and statements image search, electronic filing search, candidate and committee summary search, committee search, and candidate search. Rather than utilizing several different systems, you often will be able to obtain much of the information you need from a single query. The viewer is also very versatile, allowing users to access the data in sortable columns. It doesn't just give the user large numbers, but also allows options to drill down to specific transactions. The viewer also puts each committee's large numbers into perspective, with graphics that can lay out the big picture of receipts and disbursements in a quick glance. Finally, the viewer allows users to download complete sets of data in a spreadsheet format for further filtering, queries, and examination. For these reasons and many more, it's plain to see how the FEC's viewer and campaign finance disclosure portal open new doors for the public to access campaign finance data.
Okay.
That was pretty quick. I'd like to focus on just a few of the things in the viewer that are improvements on older systems. Like the video mentioned, it replaces the report image system, the e-filing search system, the candidate committee summary, and candidate search and committee search. So you can, with this, often in the past, you'd have to do two or three searches in the different systems to get what you were looking for. Here you can do it with a single search. On top of that, almost every aspect of this is sortable and exportable. So if you come up with a list and you're looking for something in the list, you can sort it in different ways. And if you want to dump it into Excel, it's just one click to do that. Okay. Now, as far as the first part is the search screen. Now, everybody these days uses search screens, and there's really no mystery here. If I hit the more search options, you'll see all of the search options. There are three things, however, I'd like to point out. You can search for the name of a candidate and the name of a committee, including, unlike the old systems where you had to get the name exactly right, you could, for instance, I believe Adam Smith, there are four. There's Adam Smith, the candidate, and several committees with Adam Smith in the name. And that was by searching for Adam Smith. If I search for Smith, comma, Adam, I get the same set. In the old system, you had to search Smith, comma, Adam to get what you were looking for. So it's a smarter search system. The same box, if you happen to have, for instance, a committee ID, and I just grabbed this one, you can also search by committee ID. And because a committee ID is unique, instead of taking you to a list, it takes you straight to the results for that committee. But I'm not ready to go there yet, so let's go back to the search box. You can also search in the same box with image numbers. If you want to look at a specific image of a report, a page of a report, and you paste or type it in there, it'll take you straight to that page of the report. Now, down here, the committee type, we've expanded this a lot. We've put a lot of other things on it. For instance, now you don't have to know that independent expenditure-only committees are super PACs. You can see the word super PACs here, and you can choose that and do a quick search and get all 895 super PACs here. And as I mentioned before, it's sortable. By default, it shows the most recent ones first. This is 2012. And then alphabetical within that group. But if I just wanted to do it by name, maybe reverse by name, yeah, there's zombies for, I can't read it, zombies for tomorrow, right, of tomorrow, okay. For instance, I don't know anything about zombies of tomorrow, but you can find them. Also, down here at the bottom, these are things that were mostly from the electronic filing search, including a date range search, and I'll come back to that as the last search that I do. But I want to use, as I usually do just because I'm used to it, American Medical Association as an example. It's a it's not an independent expenditure committee. Let's do that. It doesn't keep you from making mistakes. okay, American Medical Association, the very first one here. The first thing it takes you to is a two-year summary. Now, the two-year summary, it's very similar to the two-year summary for candidates in the House and Senate map or the presidential map. It has links, however, to all different types of activity instead of just some types of activity. For instance, operating expenditures, and you can click through and see the list of operating expenditures for American Medical Association. It's running. It's normally fast. Alec, do you have anything to add here?
Maybe they just did a file.
I don't know. Give it another few seconds here. You can see up here that it's actually doing something. It's not just sitting there. There we go. Okay. Here are the operating expenditures for the 2012 two-year period for American Medical Association. And again, you can sort them, for instance, by city. They're all in Omaha. Mm-hmm. okay, maybe this wasn't a great example, but amount you can sort by, okay? And you can also click on one of these little links to export either into Excel or to some other formats that are more computer-friendly. It has also the little graphics here. These are a little bit more interesting when you're looking at campaign committees because they typically have more different sources of income and different ways they spend their money. But the second tab, report summaries, lists all the reports from the same two-year period. And the periods go back to the 94 cycle if the committee goes back. It'll go as far back as the committee goes, back to 1994. And if you want to look at a particular, like the 2011 year-end report for this committee, it's much like the two-year summary, except the transactions that you will get are just for that particular report. This is from the 2011 year-end report. And the third tab probably has, well, it has some of my favorite things on it. It is a combination of the imaging system and the electronic filing search. If you are familiar, you'll notice that everything over to about here, the PDF link, is straight out of the imaging system. And if you click on one of these, you get the same thing you would get in the old imaging system. And I think we're having some kind of general slowness here. However, added to that are the last two columns, view HTML and download, that are straight from the e-filing search system. So if it is an electronic filing, you can also see it in this familiar format, or you can download it. And again, you can open it in Excel or in whatever editor you want to look at it in. Okay, now the date range search that I mentioned before, I'm going to use this to look at just today. We're going to do a search. And this, unlike the imaging system, the old imaging system, which only showed you things that had gone through the previous night's processing, electronic filings that have come in since last night's process.
Jeff, I think I know what the issue is. We're connected to the wireless router right now.
Oh, okay.
So that's not as fast as...
That is true.
That's my excuse.
Okay. Are you going to stick with it? All right. Okay. These are all committees that have filed something since last night's process. And I'm not reading them very well, but I'll just choose the first one because it doesn't matter. We'll go over here to their list of filings. And you'll see, instead of starting with the 2012 cycle, there's a new box at the top that has most recent electronic filings, and it'll display anything that they've filed since last night. And so you can see the that error message is specific to my machine. I don't know what it is. And this, you know, you don't have to go do a separate search into the e-filing system to see this. It's all right here. Okay, one more thing that I should do probably is to use a candidate. Anybody got any favorite? Okay, I'm going to use Denny Hoyer because he's my congressman. Okay, Denny Hoyer. Now, if you're looking at a candidate, now, this particular candidate only has one committee, and that committee is listed right here. If he had more committees, they'd be listed here as well, and the summary figures here would be a total for all of his committees. As it is, there's only one committee. And to get, of course, two Hoyer for Congress, you just click on that, and instead of candidate information here, it's committee information, including treasurer name and address and that kind of thing. So all the information is here. And again, this is a better example of the graphics. There's more categories of receipts. The other thing that we've added recently is the, let's see, the RSS feed for electronic filings. For this, you can subscribe to electronic filings so that it comes to you and tells you when they come in. So especially for reporters who are covering, you know, Omaha, they can subscribe to the candidates in their area, and it's really easy for them. They know when they file. It comes to their computers, and they can just click through and see the filings. And really, Alec, unless you can think of something else, that's the quick view. I mean, we've had pretty good feedback so far. We have had some feedback to add a few things, and we're working on those. Questions? Requests? Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Alec, thank you very much. We appreciate it. That was excellent. Thanks for all your hard work. Do you have any management or administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay, hearing none, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Does he have to drop back down?
No.